Hi, I'm Jen Suliafu, and I'm delighted to be on this journey with you. Life is an exciting game with many twists and turns. It gets really good when we begin to learn how it works and how to win. I believe that no matter where someone's life is at, we have the power to make radical shifts to create a life that truly honors us. I live for awakenings, so let's get to it, darlings. Okay, everyone, welcome back. Okay, I live for real, raw, and authentic convos. And today, I'm thrilled because we get to speak to a true badass goddess. That's what I call you. Who also goes by Mio Strong. So welcome, Mio.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Me too. I am so excited. I'm literally just got my tea. Just going to have a convo with a friend today.
Cheers. I got my pre-workout going.
Cheers. All right. I love it. So we met about 3 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. I had heard so much about you because, of course, you know, my husband, Danny, right? And he was coming home and because you trained together and he was coming home and telling me about you. And I was like, who is this woman that he is so impressed with? Because all people that know him, he's not easily impressed. And I was like, I need to get to know this woman. And he told me so many things about you. And I could just tell, like, he immediately respected you and your heart's like, you have a special connection with Danny for sure. And so it was beautiful for me to see. And I wanted to get to know you because I was intrigued, you know? And so we went to lunch about 3 years ago, right?
Yeah. It's been that long.
I know.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. And I immediately had a connection with you as well. And we had some things in common and we were able to sit and have just a deep, soulful conversation for, you know, I don't know how long we were together, but it was the beginning of a friendship. And here we are.
I know. It's so crazy because I was telling Danny yesterday when we were talking about it, I'm like, there's something about Jen that when you meet her, like, I'm sure you have that connection with a lot of people, but I immediately felt it with you and was just like, who's this woman? I'm like ready to tell her everything. And she's telling me things and we're like connecting. I'm like, why aren't more women like this?
Well, I think that, you know, we immediately had things that we had in common and we were able to like meet each other on that bridge and understand each other. Mm-hmm. And it took me many years to feel like I was ready to be open and bring down my walls. And I think that you had done a lot of work too. And so we were just there. We were ready, right?
Yeah. The stars aligned.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, everybody's on their own journey and some women, they have a lot of walls up and some have been able to bring those walls down. But when I see another fellow woman that I can like go, okay, let's, you know, have these deep conversations with, I just love it. So yeah,
me too. The more real and authentic, the connection or the way you present yourself, I feel like then that, yeah, leads to lifelong friendships. I feel like you and Danny are going to be in our lives forever.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. That's my plan.
I've actually known Danny since high school.
So yeah. Like
over 20 years.
Wow.
And then when we reconnected at jujitsu about 4 years ago, yeah, it was strange. I was like, who is this woman you're married to? It was the same thing. I was super intrigued because he was just like, man, she's this. And then, like, he just spoke so highly of you. So.
Well, we both love that man very much. Yeah. So.
Good human. That's for sure.
Yes, he is. He definitely is. So you've been through a lot, sister, and I want you to tell us your story. Tell me, you know, some of the things that you've been through. Give us an idea of who you are. I, of course, know, but I'm so excited to share you with this platform and with my people because your message is a really important one and you've learned some really important things in life. So share with us.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of things when I think of like what defines me and what I stand for and my why, there are a lot of things that come to mind. But I think to give everybody a brief overview. So it's 2021. If we go back to 2003, I feel like that's kind of my rock bottom, because in order to get to where you and I are, I feel like you have to go through some shit,
yeah,
and some pain and some dark times, and you have to persevere and be resilient, and it's all worth it in the end. But 2003, I feel like, was my universal wake up call. It was the universe saying, this is just the beginning, and you're going to be okay later on. But my mother, I grew up in a very kind of conservative, my mom's Japanese American. She was born here, but her parents were born in Japan. And my dad is pretty conservative as well. So I grew up in this house where we didn't really talk about things. We didn't really express emotions. There was no like physical hugging, snuggling. Like there were just some very straight boundaries. And anyone that knows me realizes that like physicality and expression are my love languages. And I kind of, they've always been my love languages, and I've always, and I was missing that for a long time. But to back up, so 2003, my mom is an addict, and it's prescription drugs. It's not street drugs, not alcoholism, but it is prescription drugs. And she's been an addict my whole life. She's been through rehab 7 times. And in 2003, she had an overdose that sent her to the hospital. She survived. She went back to rehab. I was also pregnant at the time. So my little brother moved in with us, my ex-husband, Brian, at the time. And he was in high school. And there's 7.5 years between my youngest brother and I. And so, well, 7 years. And I've always played that kind of motherly role growing up in a household with an addict. You know, they don't necessarily parent the same way we do right now. But I've always had a special relationship with him, and he moved in with me. I was 7 months pregnant. On my 2-year wedding anniversary, I found out my husband was having an affair. He was leaving me for his secretary or his assistant. I mean, it does not get more cliche than that. and I was completely floored. Like, I was on cloud 9, like, they're being pregnant. I was everything I wanted. I felt like I was in a good marriage, and did not realize how unhappy he was. Because while everybody's probably like, oh, he cheated on you, you're pregnant, that's terrible, I feel so bad for you, I it takes two. And I take responsibility for getting us to that point as well. I wasn't the one that stepped out, but it takes two. And it was an unhealthy relationship. But so he left at 7 months pregnant, right after my mom had OD'd, my little brother moved in. And in July of 2003, I went into labor. I was doing everything natural. I did not want to let my ex into the delivery room. But my two best friends, Gen 1 and Gen 2, who I know now we have Gen 3, who really got me through some really ugly times, some really dark times during that last trimester, they encouraged me to let him in the delivery room. I was so grateful that they pushed that, because my son, our son, ended up passing away, and he had a heart condition that his heart was too big. And there's a big, long technical term. I think the acronym is CDCF for the disease. It's very, very rare. Nobody knew anything was wrong until he was crowning. And the delivery itself, and they didn't really know it was not compatible with life, that he had this disease when he was crowning, but he wasn't fitting. So he was partway out. And granted, this is a natural childbirth, so it was pretty intense. And they realized something was wrong. He wasn't going to fit. So I remember vividly being in that bed in the hospital, and them just, okay, we're going for a C-section right now. And they were trying so hard to get me out the door so quickly. They were banging into the walls and banging into the door frame and just trying to get me in. And they did what's called a splash and slash, which is they literally just throw iodine on you and cut. And so my, yeah, it was super traumatic, especially because they were trying to place general anesthetic. They had to put me under because there just wasn't time for an epidural. So I remember laying there and him, the doctor, asking me, do you feel that? And I could feel the cut, but that's all I remember. And then I was in and out and in and out. And when I came back around, I couldn't hear Bennett crying. And I'm looking, my uncle, who I'm very close with, he was our pediatrician. So he was in the delivery room. And remember just looking at him and saying, he's not crying, he's not crying. And I could see his, you know, he's masked up and had all the proper gear on, but he was just looking at me and I could see it in his face. And I knew something was really wrong at that time. But it's just a whirlwind, right? They're working on the baby. They're working on closing me up. We're trying to figure out what's happening. It's not chaos, but it's controlled chaos in the delivery room. And my ex-husband was in there with me, and I'm really glad. I'm really glad he was there. I'm really glad he was there during the labor as well. So we get Bennett, my son, stabilized, not we, the team gets him stabilized, and we go back to the recovery room, and my uncle came in about an hour later, or not even an hour later, but it felt like an hour. He came in and just said to Brian and I, he said, LifeLight is here. We delivered at Jordan Valley. They were going to LifeLight him up to the U to, you know, the state of the art NICU and teams up there. But he's been without oxygen for so long that we do not think his brain, he'll regain function. And we didn't even hesitate. Brian and I looked at each other and we knew that we didn't want him to be life-flighted. We wanted to take him and hold him and love on him for however long. Oh, goodness. for however long we had with him. So my uncle brought him in and we got to unwrap him and kiss all over him and snuggle him and smell him. And my dad and my grandma and like my family that were there got to hold him and meet him. And I had a whole team of friends that were there to support me and everybody got to meet him. And then Brian and I were alone with him in the recovery room, and we could tell, you know, the doctor would come in every now and then and check on him. And he passed away very peacefully while I was holding him. And I'm so grateful that we made that choice. I'm grateful that we didn't try to lifeline him or put him through who knows what pain and trauma and miss out on those hours that we had with him, because it was just hours. But man, I remember every single second of those hours. I had refused any sort of pain medicine because I wanted to be alert. I wanted to be very sharp and cognizant and aware, and I didn't want to be drugged up when I had my time with him. So for those few hours, Brian, I have this picture of Brian sitting in the windowsill holding him and just having his own moment with him, because Brian and I were not living together. We were getting a divorce. Like, it was this terrible place to be between the two of us. But we were parents first on that day, and we both got our chances to say goodbye. When they took him away, that was like, whoa, the worst feeling. But luckily for me, that's when they gave me the drugs because I wanted to be done with life. I was in a rough, rough mental state, as you can imagine. And so I was able to check out and recover and sleep for 12 hours. And Brian was exhausted. Everybody was exhausted. And it was just a really life-changing moment, life-changing day, July 13th. And yeah, that is part of the change, right? When I think of Mio pre 2003 tragedies back to back to back to back, you know, then I think of who I started to become that year. And while it did not happen quickly and I made lots of mistakes and terrible choices along the way, that was like the beginning of me finding and creating who I wanted to be and who I could be proud of. And at the time, the affair really, it wrecked me. But at the same time, I was out dating and moving on with my life. And he was with that girlfriend that he had left me for. And we were kind of moving on. And we had to come together for taxes. So we did taxes together. And then we had to come together for Mother's Day. And then I decided, okay, I'm done. I'm not going to speak to you again. Like, I need to heal. I need to, like, just some distance. But on Father's Day, so Mother's Day is in May. Father's Day is June. It had been about a month. And he called me on his first Father's Day without Bennett. And that's when I couldn't ignore him. I couldn't let him sit in that pain alone, because I had known that. Because while I was out dating, I dated some incredible men and met some incredible humans, but not a single one of them understood grief and loss to the extent that I did. And that just was kind of this wedge or this wall or just a barrier between whoever I was getting close with. They just didn't quite understand the depth of grief and how it changes you. Now, I'm grateful for people that don't understand that. I don't want people to go through it, but it does change you. So I had been a little bit frustrated out around dating. And then Brian calls me on Father's Day and he just told me, you know, I've left this girl. I made a huge mistake. I need to do better. I'm changing. I'm doing therapy. I'm blah, 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 blah. Everything I ever wanted to hear, he told me. And so we started dating again. And a year later, Brian and I got remarried. So it's kind of a strange thing because we are now divorced. In 2021, we've been divorced over a year. So it's a strange journey. But 2003, when we lost Bennett, when we got back together in 2004, I really wanted another child with the same DNA, with the same partner, I wanted a sibling to my son. And we had done extensive genetic testing because all of the doctors were flabbergasted. They didn't know why Bennett was sick. They didn't know what caused it. They had no idea. And before we had other children, we wanted to make sure that, you know, the risk was not even mild to have that same thing happen.
Did you go full term with him?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Full term. Yeah. And we got pregnant with Marie, my 14-year-old. She's 14 right now. And she was a twin. And at about 16 weeks, we miscarried the twin. And I was not devastated. So this is the strange thing is I remember going to that ultrasound and Brian and I are sitting there and she's looking for the other heartbeat. She can't find it. They call the doctor in. You know, it's a nightmare for a lot of women. But I kept just this iron grasp on the fact that there was another baby in there and she was fine. And okay, what do we do? What am I going to do to keep this child safe? Because a lot of my last trimester with Bennett, I was in a lot of pain because of the affair, because of being left. I couldn't really eat. I wasn't sleeping. I was barely functioning. And I was holding on to a lot of that guilt because I felt like maybe I did something wrong or maybe I didn't do something I should have, or it was my fault that Bennett was sick. It was my fault that he died. So I was still holding on to that. And I really wanted to do everything in my power to make sure that I did everything right for every pregnancy moving forward. So when we miscarried the twin, Brian was devastated. I was not. I was just clinging to this healthy baby girl in there and just put my shoulder to the wheel and I focused on, I'm going to sleep, I'm going to eat, I'm going to exercise, I'm going to do all the things that I can that are in my control to make sure this baby girl gets here okay and healthy. And she was born full term. And they did a C-section. Because of the vertical incision of my emergency C-section, you can't really do a VBAC after that. So we knew she was going to be C-section. We kind of planned it. We went to a high-risk perinatologist doctor the whole pregnancy. Like, we were really taken care of. But she was born and she had something called necrotizing enterocolitis, which is essentially death of the bowel. And she had a pneumothorax in her lungs, but we didn't know anything was wrong, of course, until she was born and we take her back to the recovery room. The delivery's fine. And she starts turning purple. And that was because of her lung problem. But then once she was in the NICU, they were discovering all these other problems. So she ended up being in the NICU for several months and she had to have surgery, spinal taps, tests. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. It was this nightmare. We were reliving this nightmare. But she pulled through, they figured out what was wrong and we fixed it in time. They went in and fixed her bowel because necrotizing enterocolitis is like a death of the bowel or like your bowel is twisted. And so blood supply is cut off and, it can cause all sorts of, it can cause death. It's really serious. And she, actually was overdosed on morphine and coded out while we were in recovery. Her NG tube got caught. It was tied in a knot and got caught and they couldn't take it out. I mean, she just had all these like roadblocks, but we brought her home finally and she's healthy. She's happy. She's an incredible human. And she always has been. And so we were happy. We were focused on the family, focused on Marie. And then we had another little girl, Miss Maya. She's almost 11 now. And it's so funny with Maya because same thing. We had a high-risk doctor. We were monitored very, very closely at the U. We had a great team. At the day she was born, she was crying. She was healthy. Everything checked out. We were good to go. 24 hours later, I was like, I'm leaving the hospital, doctor. Like, and Dr. Draper is my perinatologist. He was like, no, you're not. You just had a C-section. I was like, yes, I am. Check me out. Sign the papers. I'm fine. I'm walking. I'm pooping. I'm peeing. My baby's fine. Get me out of here. Like, I just wanted to be done with the hospital. And I knew Maya was my last baby. They tied my tubes during the delivery. Once they realized, you know, once they checked out Maya, I knew everything was fine. And so I just wanted out of there. And Maya has been my little hellfire, healthy spitfire child since that day. So we always laugh that Maya, well, we don't laugh. Maya likes to remind everybody that she was just the healthiest baby there ever was. And she was the toughest and she just was the fattest. And wow. Yeah.
I love it. There's something about the youngest that's like this little sassy, you know, fireball.
Yes.
Listening to you, this is so interesting because we had a really in-depth conversation 3 years ago, but it was the first time we met. This is a different conversation because even though we went deep that time, I now remember, because we don't talk about this stuff when we see each other, right? Like, we enjoy our time together and it's a lot more fun and light. We don't really talk about these really hard things a lot. And I'm remembering why we had such a connection, because there's so many things in your story that I'm like, yes, sister, I hear you. I feel you. You know, I remember feeling very different in some ways, but also very similar in other ways. Like when you talked about, you know, feeling like you had guilt of what you had been going through. I have felt that for many years with my son, because I was also going through a divorce and I was also 7 months pregnant. So that's interesting. And then even just you talking about your Maya, our baby's a Mia and she's our like little, you know, so fascinating, like so many similarities.
Yeah.
But, wow. I love it. What have been your biggest lessons from all of that?
Yeah, it's been repeated lessons, I feel like, because I obviously, when anybody experiences death or grief to that extent, I feel like you understand just the fragility of life and the absolute miracle it is to get a healthy baby here, and that you don't ever stop worrying. It's not, they don't turn 18 or they don't get to crawling or whatever stage it is that the child gets to. You don't think, oh, I can relax now. Oh no, it's a whole nother set of worry and vigilance to make sure that these humans are protected and taken care of. Yet at the same time, you don't want to be an overbearing helicopter parent who puts your child in a bubble and doesn't really prepare them for real life. I think of all the parental lessons, I mean, I keep learning those ones I mentioned over and over again, but I also am proud of and have learned that you can't control everything. Mm-hmm. And no matter what, you have to be able to adapt. And that comes to the, was it Freud or I'm trying to remember. No, it was the anthropologist that said, it's not the strongest of the species or the fastest or the smartest that survive. It's the most adaptable. And that is how I live my life now. It's like adapting the best way we can, preparing, but also knowing that you have to let some things go. I was a super, super control freak prior to 2003, like very controlling. And I feel like that was part of the downfall of my marriage, was that I was so overbearing and so controlling and so just dominating that it backfired, you know? And so I've learned a lot of lessons, but that life is short, and be more patient as a parent. That's another thing. I don't take it for granted that I have these children. And it really used to get under my skin when women would complain about just the most mundane things with their children. And I was like, yeah, but you have a baby that's here, that's healthy, that, you know, stop complaining that you have to buy too many diapers or that your boob is falling off from nursing, or, you know what I mean? Like, there, but I've come a long way in that area too. I tend not to judge as much anymore and just be like, okay, they have not experienced what we have experienced. And so their perspective is different. It's not wrong necessarily. It's just different. So patience. Yeah.
Put your wine in. Just kidding.
I'm like, you're complaining about being fat. At least you're effing pregnant. Like, come on.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Well, so looking at your social media, I love it. I love your social media, because looking at it is like what you see from my perspective, and I'm sure most people, is just this badass, strong, confident woman who is just, you know, doesn't have any insecurities. Like, literally, like, that's what we see when we look at your Instagram. I'm speaking for all the women, so I'm sure not everyone, but it's so, you know, there would be times where I would see your posts and I would read them and I would just be like, hell yeah. It was like a hand reached in and it was like just shaking me, because that's what you're, to me, that's what your message is, of like, you can be anything,
yeah,
you know, regardless of what you've gone through. And I know that there's so many more things that you've been through. There's a lot, of course, but I want to get to that with your message, but do you feel like, you know, what do you say to that when I say, you know, looking at your social media, that's what we all see?
You know, it's interesting, because when I started social media, I was very intentional about the way I was going to approach it and my accountability. You're never going to hear something that I don't genuinely believe in or that I'm not going through. And I hope that people actually read what I write and not just look at the images, because a lot of my messaging is very vulnerable. Like, I'm very true to, like, hey, it's just a shitty time right now. And I just have to pick myself up and just take one step, because one step is better than no steps. And one step is going to add up, and pretty soon you'll be through the darkness. While I'm glad everybody's reading it or everybody's exposed to it and I'm putting it out there publicly, it's also my journal and my accountability. And I can, of course, because it's mine, but like, go through the years and like look at my postings and read, and I can just see, like, and it's, growth is not a straight shot up the mountain, right? I mean, you can see me like, oh my gosh, I left a gym, my life is over. okay, I found a great gym. Oh shit, I'm getting divorced. Damn. Okay, wait, I'm back out. Oh, I'm successful on the mats. Okay, but my parenting sucks. Oh, dang. Like, you know what I mean? It's this like gradual battle uphill. And that's what life is, right? But I try very hard to be honest, like own my losses, own my own struggles. And in doing so, it takes the power away too. And I know that sounds weird, but in jujitsu, I had many, many, many insecurities. And because I had a lot of followers, but I was like, I suck at jujitsu. Like, why are they following me? Like, am I like, it's this weird, like, you have to have confidence in yourself to be a really good competitor, but you also have to understand everybody loses. Everybody loses. And if you go to some athlete's page and all you see are the highlights, that's probably a miserable athlete. Like my very first humiliating loss was at the Pan American Games in California. It was like 5 years ago. And I owned it. I posted a picture of me after the match and I just look like shit. Like I am just beat up from the feet up. And I had not barely survived. I mean, I just was humiliated. I think she beat me like 14-2 or something. It was just a real solid ass kicking. But I posted her as my Woman Crush Wednesday. And I turned the narrative around from like, poor me, I'm so humiliated, I'm so embarrassed, to like, hey, thank you. I got a chance to fight one of the top level girls. She taught me so much about where the holes are in my game. And women in jiu-jitsu are rare. So, I mean, there's more and there's the divisions are growing and everything. But back then, we were all lumped together. Granted, it was by weight class, but not by age. Everybody was there. And it was just to get us matches. So without my opponent, I couldn't have competed, right? So I turned that narrative around and laid it all out there for a Women's Crush Wednesday. And I got so many messages from other female athletes, regardless of the sport, that is just like, man, that helped me shift my perspective. Thank you. And just lots of good feedback based on putting my vulnerabilities out there and owning them and owning my losses, because I sure as shit am going to celebrate my wins. I'm going to celebrate like all the hard work and dedication and everything I put in there to get to that point. But you have to own your losses. And it's the same way in life. Like I own, like I'm in an amazing relationship with an incredible man. I have a great career. Like I'm in such a great place right now, but I own that it sucked to get here. Mm-hmm. Like it sucked. My kids suffered and they still suffer. They're still hurting over all of the changes, all of the turmoil that divorce brings with it. Mm-hmm. And I have to own the fact that I hurt my kids and that I did fail in my marriage. And even though I don't view it as a failure, it's definitely, I wish I never would have had to hurt him or hurt myself or hurt my kids. But at the same time, I would go through it all again. I would do it all again if I knew this is where I was going to be.
Yeah. Yes.
Like it's
I feel that. Yeah. So you're recently divorced, but hold up, guys. She's not available. So don't get too crazy excited. So tell me about finding new love. Like, you know, how is that?
It's
tell me about your relationship. And when you say you would do it all over again, oh, yes, I feel that so much because it is so hard to have that on your heart. When, you know, when I was going through my divorce, I thought, okay, as soon as the day's final, I'm going to have like a divorce party. It's going to be like, woohoo, we're moving on. And when you said that word failure, it was like, yes, that's what I felt, is like to my two children. It was like, I don't feel like having a party. I feel like I've failed you. And learning that you can move on and find something like you've never had before. Because right now, all day long, I would say I would do it all over again to have what I have now, because I didn't even know what was waiting for me.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like seeing you and Jason together, I feel like that's what I see when I look at the two of you. So tell me about that.
Yeah. He's the most incredible man. And I've known him for years. We've trained together. We've traveled together. We've competed together. He's always been just a solid human. Like, I've always known he's just a solid dude, right? Like, he trains respectfully with women. He is a fabulous dad. That was another thing. And he laughs all the time because I call him a feminist and he hates that word. But I always knew he was a feminist based on how he was raising his children. He has a daughter. His oldest is a daughter, is a girl. And then he has two boys. And I would see him because he used to teach the kids class. All of his kids would train. They'd come to tournaments. Like, I felt like I had a good, honest view of how he parents. And man, I was so impressed. Like, he's just a solid, there's a lot of him that's old school, like just like hard work, respect, you know, the kind of old school manly man stuff. But at the same time, he's like, my daughter's going to have every opportunity that any boy her age can have. She can do, be, say, climb any ladder, shatter any glass ceiling. Like, she can do whatever she wants. And I'm going to make sure it's fair and that she does it and that she puts in the hard work. So I had always had just tons of respect for him from afar. And he happened to be going through a divorce at the same time. We were always friends on the mat. And during the roughest times of my adult life in the last 5-10 years, fitness or martial arts has been my coping mechanism. And with Jason, it was the same thing. We both like threw ourselves into jiu-jitsu and training, and he does MMA as well, but we just threw ourselves into training to cope and to escape, but also to work through our own issues. Like, my kids have always said, you know, go train mom and then we'll talk about it. Cause they know post-training, I'm much more patient, much more calm. Oh, yeah.
I feel that with Danny for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they want us to go train. And Jason and I just grew closer and closer and closer. We were traveling together, competing together, getting to know each other just a lot on a deeper level. And he is probably the opposite of anyone I ever would have. Like, if we were on a dating app and I had a list of attributes for him and a list of attributes for me, other than jujitsu and like competitiveness and some other things, I would not think we were compatible at all, because we have a lot of surface fundamental differences, but they're just surface. And because we had this deeper connection, we took the time to get to know our differences and where they were coming from. And we realized, they're not that different. Like, okay, we can see that there's middle ground, and where there isn't middle ground, we're both stubborn enough and assured enough in our assuredness. We have assuredness in our own core values that we don't really wishy-washy change for anyone. So if we truly believe in something, we're going to stand our ground. Does that mean I'm going to hate him or fight with him over it or, you know, be disrespectful? No. Like, I respect him. And he's also the first man ever in my entire life to put me in my place. Weird.
Wow.
Weird, right? How that works. Cause most men would think, oh, like placate or like put them on a pedestal. Oh. But they want
no strong way.
Like alpha males need a stronger alpha male. I feel He puts me in my place, and I've never had that. And he doesn't do it in a disrespectful or mean or spiteful way. He just has these like ethics and boundaries, and he sticks to them. And if it doesn't sit right, and he always says, and I'm sorry for all the swear words, but he always says, fuck your feelings. Like, I want to know the truth. And I want you to tell me the truth, and I'm going to tell you the truth. And it may not make you feel all warm and fuzzy inside, but it's the truth, and you deserve the truth. And I feel like that set the standard from the very beginning. We've been together just a little bit over a year or almost a year, but friends for a long, long time. But that has come back in play over and over and over again. Like the truth. I'm honest. And all of my trust issues from my previous marriage, all of my fears, all my insecurities, like there's just no room for them. I believe him, like in the core of my being. I believe that he loves me. I believe that he will always do the right thing, even if it's hard, like, especially if it's hard, he's proven over again that he will do the right thing and he will call you out if you're not doing the right thing either.
Wow. That is priceless. It is really priceless. Like when you say, you know, to have a partner that's going to tell you the truth mm-hmm. and that you truly trust, you know, I work with people on a daily basis that I'm seeing behind their walls, and trust is rare, like true trust, you know, and having someone that is going to be there for you and do the right thing is, it's everything. Priceless.
Well, and somebody also who sees you, like I was very honest and open with him about all of my shortcomings and bad decisions and choices in the past that I'm not proud of. Like I went into this thinking, okay, this, I'm laying it all on the line. Like I can't do another marriage or relationship based on like convenience or we have kids or it's working out, but true intimacy, I feel can't be reached unless you have that trust. And I had never regained that trust in my previous marriage. And I put that aside for the convenience of like, he's a great provider and we get along. We're really good friends and he's a good dad. You know, like I kind of put away my own need for intimacy and I paid for it. Like that was the downfall of our marriage. Like he and I had no connection. There was no intimacy. There was no truth. There was no passion. And I think you can't have passion without intimacy and you can't have intimacy without trust. And Jason and I, man, that man, I can't get enough of him. Like, and I feel like that intimacy came from this vulnerability and this place of trust and vulnerability. And he met me in the middle and I met him and we both agreed, this is how we're going to do this relationship. And because of that, we have this level of intimacy and connection that like makes me blush thinking of, because like, I can't get enough of him. And I genuinely feel like he can't get enough of me. And it's such a fulfilling, loving, happy place. So grateful. I mean, and I want to kill him some days for like the usual things, but we have the core values. We have the core connection and man, we're just like taking this relationship and running with it. It's, we both are super happy.
Oh my gosh. So happy for you. I love it. That's so awesome. It's so fun to see the two of you too. Like, to go to dinner with you and be like, hello.
We're here. Stop touching each other.
Oh my gosh. I love it. No, it's great. It's great. I can definitely see your connection for sure.
Yeah. And we both were missing that. Like we just settled for no chemistry, no intimacy. Like we kind of joke that like he never, ever even believed in the term making love. Like he just had seen it as sex from day one. Like that was it. Like he had never, ever seen it. And now it's like, oh my gosh, like it is making love. Like when there is intimacy and passion and that connection, that it's a whole different world. Like what? We're in our 40s and we never knew it could be like this.
Go on to another world, honey.
Yep.
Go to another world, another universe. I love it. That's awesome. So I want you to talk about your work with Elizabeth Smart before we end here. I want to touch on that for sure. So tell us about your work with Elizabeth Smart. Why you even do that work?
Yeah, it's crazy. I love how it's all turned out. Yeah, it's been a very fortuitous coming together of circumstances. So I am a survivor of sexual abuse. I was sexually abused from the time I was 8 years old until high school and by a family member. And that really broke me, defined me. It doesn't, I'm a survivor. I'm not a victim of sexual violence. And it took me a while to change that narrative. But jujitsu helped a lot. So coming back to jujitsu 5 years ago, five and a half years ago, it was a way to like reconnect with my body. I knew I was done having kids. Like I kind of was over the big box gyms. I didn't really like aerobics classes. I didn't really like lifting weights by myself. I like camaraderie. I like touch. Physical touch is my love language. I like competition. Like I'm super competitive. So it just fit. Jiu-jitsu fit. And I just poured myself into jiu-jitsu. And the byproduct of doing that was healing my wounds from the sexual abuse, appreciating, loving, respecting my body, letting go of the shame and the guilt and the like dirty, I have baggage, I'm dirty, I'm damaged goods, kind of letting go of all of those internal narratives through jiu-jitsu. And I started teaching self-defense with one of my best friends, Chelsea Kilpak. She's a fellow jiu-jitsu Muay Thai athlete. She's amazing. And she also was on the board at the Utah Coalition Against Sexual Assault. So she and I put together our powers. She had the education piece. I had the physical piece. We put it together and we ran with this self-defense program. But we both had full-time jobs and, you know, other life got in the way. So we were only teaching maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And one of my junior high friends, Dave Gray, his dad is involved in the Elizabeth Smart Foundation. And when they were looking for an instructor for their self-defense program, he said, you've got to meet Mio. So we went to lunch, Elizabeth, Sterling, Dave, Chelsea and I, and we just hit it off. And really, it was fortuitous timing. I had just been gotten divorced and I didn't have health insurance. I was a, you know, self-employed photographer prior to that. And now looking at having to like, you know, really financially step up. And there's just not a lot of, while I was a successful photographer, it's not very regular. And I was kind of craving a little bit more regular schedule, some health insurance. Like I was really interested in looking for a different career. And then this meeting happened and it just took off from there. Elizabeth and I hit it off. Sterling and I hit it off, Dave, Chelsea, everything came together. And it turned out, you know, Chelsea wasn't able to leave her position or didn't want to. And I took on the program and Jason and I really poured our heart and soul into developing the curriculum. And the thing I'm so proud of for Smart Defense is that we address the education piece. So there are lots of techniques that can get you out of chokeholds and that you can like, you know, learn how to throw an effective elbow or an effective knee. But if you can't recognize warning signs and red flags and set clear, healthy boundaries in your relationships, if you don't have healthy relationships to model your current relationships after, or, you know, there's all these things that happen prior to experiencing sexual violence that have nothing to do with physically getting away. So our program focuses a lot on education. And let me get this out there right now. Under no circumstance is anybody responsible for their abuse. Nobody deserves to be abused. And the only way to truly prevent rape or sexual violence is for those perpetrators not to rape. Like, that's the only guarantee, right? There's nothing that we can do as survivors or victims, as women, as anyone, to 100% guarantee no sexual violence. That is on the perpetrators. That is on the attackers. That is on the sick individuals. Those are the choices they're making. It's never the responsibility of the victim. And fight, flight, freeze, appease, they're all physiological responses that we have no control over. So at Smart Defense, what we're trying to do is, you know, get the body mechanics down, get the education piece in, support each other as women. We're trying to create this network of people that just show up for each other. And we all need that. And especially survivors. I think, you know, in Utah, it's 1 in 3 females will experience sexual violence in their lifetime. So, you know, you have a daughter, I have 2 daughters, the 2 of us, you know what I mean? Look at the odds. Like, we're going to know somebody or love somebody that is dealing with that or has dealt with that. And so showing up for each other is a huge part of not prevention or treatment, but just empowerment. I think we all have a responsibility to each other to do better for each other. So I'm really proud of our program. COVID threw some wrenches in our plan. So we're launching an online curriculum and we are doing in-person training. We're just really strict on our COVID guidelines and working around it and trying to make sure everybody's safe. But honestly, since lockdown and COVID, the domestic violence numbers, the suicide numbers, the mental, I mean, they have skyrocketed. And so now more than ever, we need to address mental illness and mental health and supporting each other and being able to figure out ways that even with COVID to do our part to end sexual violence.
Yeah. Wow. Oh my gosh. You're amazing. Okay. I'm going to end with this and I'm going to try to get through it without crying because your words just really hit me. But this is one of your posts and I'm going to read it. Okay. I have been overwhelmed with the beauty of countless women who share a piece of their pain to help others, to surrender to the healing of their trauma in their own journey and allow us to access their scars. They show us time and time that we will rise. We will not cower or be defined by the acts against us, but rather live a life of love, strength, and compassion. These brave, relentless, strong women inspire me. They are the catalyst for change. They are our sisters, mothers, wives, friends, and daughters. They will not go quietly, and we will stand together. Wow. That's it right there, honey. That's it.
And that's you. That's what you're doing. That's what we're all doing.
So beautiful. You are so beautiful inside and out. So thank you for being so authentic and open and raw and having this convo with me. I live for hanging out with people like you and spending time together and sharing your message. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being the person and having the space and the platform and the energy to share it. You know what I mean? It's so reciprocal. I get so much out of our time together too.
Everyone, you can check out the Elizabeth Smart Foundation that Miel works with under www.elizabethsmartfoundation.org. The link will be in the notes below.
Thank you for being here this week. Have a fabulous week and bye for now.
Do you have a coach? I would love to take this journey with you to dive deep and start to shift those areas to create a life that truly honors you. I'll meet you on that bridge at whatever level you are ready with either group or one-on-one coaching. You can check out my programs at jensuliafu.com/programs. Also, go ahead and hit that subscribe button and rate and review this show and give me your feedback. Also, please share this with your friends and family and be a lighthouse out in the world. Thanks for joining me.